All right. Hey, everybody. This is Ken Griffith. Generations of Heaven and Earth, Compendium of World History. This is our purpose is a biblically consistent history of the world. And this is the fourth lecture, Abraham and Job, 1996 BC to 1821 BC. So, review from last time. At the end of Act 3, we've had the tongues are confused at Babel. The nations have scattered and are going to their places. Nimrod persists in trying to keep a world empire, so he starts invading his neighbors and trying to keep everyone under his thumb, even though you already had the confusion of tongues. Shem and his posse of patriots eventually execute Nimrod, and then Noah dies and Abraham is born, and Abraham is the new hope. Abraham was, I would say, one of the world's first scientists and theologians, although Josephus tells us that Adam and Seth studied the world, and they studied the heavens, and they came up with a system of mathematics based on the heavens. Abraham is definitely a disciple of them, and apparently somehow got that information and expanded on it himself. Now, we are told by most Bible dictionaries that Abraham came from Ur of the Chaldees. Well, the Bible tells us that. But they say, well, Ur is down here in Iraq, in a place, an ancient city called Ur 3, meaning the layer number 3, which they say was about the same time as Abraham. There's a number of problems with that theory. Can you all see well enough to see which side of the Euphrates River is this little dot called Ur on?
South side.
South side. Which side of the Euphrates would Jerusalem be on?
The west.
It's still on the southwestern side, right? So we have a problem because Joshua said to all the people, "Thus says the Lord God of your fathers, of Israel, your fathers, including Terah, the father of Abraham and the father of Nahor, dwelt on the other side of the river in old times, and they served other gods. Then I took your father Abraham from the other side of the river and led him throughout the land of Canaan and multiplied his descendants and gave him Isaac." So we have a problem is that description doesn't fit this city. And even though the Euphrates River has moved around a lot, Ur has always been on the south side of the Euphrates because it's kind of up on the edge of the river valley. So the river can't go to the south of Ur or the west of it. So there's another Ur. Up in southern Turkey, there's a city called Haran. And we know that Haran is where Abraham's father stopped. Remember, God called Terah out. Terah takes Abraham and the family, and he starts going, and he didn't go very far, and then he stopped and said, well, we'll just live here. And that is the city of Haran, which is apparently named after, I think it's named after his son who died, because Haran, I believe, was Sarah's father. So near there is a town that's today called Sanli Urfa, but in ancient times was called Urfa. And this Urfa, it comes from the name Arpaxad. Arpaxad was the son of Shem, who was the ancestor of Eber, who was the ancestor of Abraham. And Arpaxad is basically the URFA is basically the first part of his name, Urpa, or Urfa. And the second part, Kasad, is what later became the Hebrew word for the Chaldeans, the Kazadim. And people in this area later called themselves the Kazdi or the Chaldi. Oops. And it so turns out that the oldest Stonehenge-type monument for studying the stars has been dug up very close to the city of Urfa, which could be where Abraham learned some of this stuff. So we have now a revised, biblically consistent path for Abraham. Urfa is on the other side of the Euphrates, and Haran is right next to it. So we can see that God called Terah, and they came this far, and Terah said, that's as far as we go. And then when he died, Abraham came the rest of the way. And then when he sent his servant back to get a wife for Isaac, he went right back here. And then when Jacob went back to get a wife, he went right back there. So apparently that's the place I need to go.
You've been saving that one for a long time.
I just popped into my head, actually. So let's look at the chronology of the period. So the year that a couple years after the dispersion, you had Egypt was founded. The city of Thebes was founded by Mizraim, also known as Menes. Between 2068 and 2036, you had about a 25-30 year war called the Clash of the Titans, where you had the followers of Shem, also called the followers of Set by the Egyptians, because they've used Set, that's basically Seth, and they've turned Seth into a god, and he's the evil god. So there was a war where the people in the Delta were supporting the followers of Set, and the people in Upper Egypt, which is actually south, they were the ones supporting Nimrod and Isis and the mystery religion. So toward the end of that period, or actually at the beginning of that period, there was a war of unification fought in Egypt to bring those two kingdoms back together. Around the year 2000 BC, you had a seven-year famine. This is not Joseph's famine. This is a previous one. And this one, it actually is mentioned in multiple cultures of the ancient Middle East. It's mentioned in reference to Terah, Abraham's father. It's mentioned in reference to a pharaoh named Djoser, who built the step pyramid. It's called a step pyramid or a ziggurat pyramid. It's mentioned in the Epic of Gilgamesh, and it's mentioned in the record of Den, who was a king at the end of the first dynasty, who is probably the same guy as Gilgamesh, actually. So, 1996, Abraham is born in Ur Kasidim, which, as we suggested, is probably Urfa in Turkey. And at this time, Den dies, and in the Egyptian Dynasty I, there is a character called Semsem, or Semempsis, or Semukere. And the depiction of him, he looks like an old man holding a staff with a long white beard and a nose like Doug Wilson. And a number of scholars believe that that was actually Shem, and that Shem appears to have gone to Egypt and tried to sort out the mess that Nimrod and Naamah and their son, their monstrous son, left behind. So now it gets very interesting is at the same time, Nimrod, so when he had died, he was using Nineveh in Assyria as his capital. And his son, Arioch, teams up with these other guys. Apparently, Chedorlaomer, he's also mentioned in the records as a king of Elam. And they try to conquer Egypt as well as the area around the Dead Sea. Now, they failed to conquer Egypt, but they conquered the tribes around the Dead Sea, which the Bible tells us. Now, in the year 1925 BC, a guy named Khufu comes to the throne, also known as Cheops. He is the builder of the Great Pyramid, which was the first pyramid. And we're told by Herodotus that it took 30 years. There was 10 years of preparation, and in 20 years they built the Great Pyramid. The Great Pyramid is, to this day, the largest building by volume in the world. And it is one of the oldest buildings, if not the oldest building in the world. And it was perfect. The Great Pyramid, it was eight-sided. It was smooth. Today it's all blocky because the Arabs stole all the outer limestone. But it had a casing of, not limestone, white granite. So it had a white granite casing, and it was perfectly smooth, and it reflected the sun because the little crystals, the moon and the sun were both reflected off of it. And the Bible refers to it as the Pillar of Egypt. So the question is, who built the Great Pyramid, and why did they build it? Because there are no idols in it. It seems to be a mathematical, it's just a testament to someone who knew the math, the science of not just the land, but also had studied the heavens and knew the circumference of the earth. I'm going to butcher it here, but if you look into the Great Pyramid, you will find that it is one of the marvels and foremost inventions that man has ever made. So 1921 BC, Abraham is finally called, and he leaves his home in Haran when his father dies, and he goes all the way to Egypt because there's a famine in Canaan. And this happens to be what we know from history exactly when the Great Pyramid was getting ready to be built. He arrived there in the third year of Khufu. Now, Berosus mentions, so I'm going to read some quotes. This is Josephus. Berosus mentions our father Abraham, though he does not name him, in the following words. In the 10th generation after the flood, there was a certain man among the Chaldeans, just and great and expert in celestial matters. This is from Pseudo-Epolemus. Abraham excelled in all nobility and wisdom. He sought and obtained the knowledge of astrology and Chaldean craft. When they say astrology, they mean astronomy when they're talking about that time, that period of time. Obviously, the attribution of the stars of having the powers to determine your life is turning them into gods, and that's astrology, and we reject that. But to become an astrologer, first you have to be an astronomer, and Abraham apparently taught them astronomy. So he traveled to Phoenicia and dwelt there. He pleased the Phoenician king by teaching Phoenicians the cycles of the sun and the moon and everything else as well. In Egypt, Abraham lived in Heliopolis with the Egyptian priests and taught them much. He explained astrology and the other sciences to them. So remember, the Greeks considered astrology to be a science. So they basically mean astronomy. Now, Herodotus extensively interviewed an Egyptian priest. By the way, Herodotus was a historian in Greece from about the 5th century BC. So he's the first Greek historian who traveled around the world and wrote books about it. So he went to Egypt, and he interviewed the Egyptian priests, and he was told that a noted stranger lived in Egypt at the time of Cheops, which is Khufu, which is, we'll find out, a shepherd to whom, rather than to Cheops, the Egyptians attribute the edifice. The Egyptians called him Philetion or Philitus. Now, in the Bible, in the book of Job, at one point, God questions Job, and this passage, it's very interesting. He says, "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Who stretched the line upon it? To what were its foundations fastened? Who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together, all the sons of God shouted for joy." Now, the earth does not look like a structure. It doesn't look like a house. It doesn't look like a temple. It's a big ball. But God is comparing the creation of the earth to building of a massive structure. And later, Jesus compares himself to the capstone. He says, the stone that the builders have rejected has become, now it's translated cornerstone, but it's also translated capstone. And the Great Pyramid today is missing the capstone. But I believe it's a reference to the capstone of the Great Pyramid. So there are a number of people, specifically Herman Ho and one or two others, who have advanced the theory that Job was Khufu, that Cheops is Job. You have the name similarity, but there's also more similarities. So of Khufu, we're told that he closed the temples and prohibited the Egyptians from offering sacrifices to their gods because he served a god named Amen. And the god who Cheops served was named Amen. Anybody have a Bible down here? No. Revelation 2? We have a name of Jesus Christ. Revelation 2, one of his names is the great Amen. Cheops was a foreign king whose domain extended into the delta of Egypt. From the also, one of his names is related to the word for Seir, where Esau lived, around Petra, which is just kind of a little bit east of Israel. So Mount Seir is associated with Khufu. They say the Great Pyramid was built by shepherds, and he was arrogant toward the gods, but he repented and he wrote a sacred book. And it was a work of great importance. This is all what we're told by the ancient chroniclers about Khufu. And it happens that Job is pretty close to these points. And this is the ancient world. There weren't that many people in the world back then. So when you have two characters who have these things in common, there's a very strong possibility that they are actually the same person. So I will leave that as for consideration, but obviously I'm not saying Job was absolutely Khufu. Job built the Great Pyramid. I'm saying Job could have been Khufu who built the Great Pyramid. But Abraham was not there. He obviously didn't participate in building it, but he was there during the planning stage, and it's possible that that he actually was the shepherd who gave them the mathematics that they used to build it. So now we have another character in Abraham's lifetime. He encounters a guy named Melchizedek. Now in Hebrew, is Ruth down here? What does Melchi mean? Or Melech? King. Is your name Ruth?
Ruth, she just had a
fall in her throat. Okay. So Melech means king. It's also where the word Moloch, remember, there's an evil god named Moloch, and they sacrifice children to him. So that's just a different form of the same name. They're worshiping the king. They're worshiping the state. But here you have Melchizedek. His Melech means king. Zadok means righteousness. So he's a righteous king. And he's living in Jerusalem, actually Salem. And Abraham, after he defeats Chedorlaomer and Arioch, the son of Nimrod, he defeats their forces, and then Shem comes out, and he blesses him, and he gives him bread and wine. And we just ate bread and wine today.
Yes,
we did. We are carrying on a very ancient tradition. Shem, according to the biblical chronology, was still alive quite actually past this, almost, I'd say, that was the year 1897. So he lived almost 70 years after that. So it definitely could have been Shem. And the reason I believe that Melchizedek was Shem is that what we have in Genesis is the priesthood of the world is kind of being traced down through the line, because we're waiting for the coming seed of the woman who's going to be the high priest who saves us all. And Noah is the only righteous man, and through his priesthood, all the animals and the people that were with him were saved through the ark. And he comes out. What's the first thing he does? He builds an altar and makes a sacrifice. So Noah is the high priest of the world. Now, I think the high priesthood would have passed to Ham if Ham was the firstborn of Noah. But because of Ham's sin, when Noah put the curse on Canaan, he blesses Shem. He mentions Shem next, and that tells us Shem is the secondborn. And Shem has now been given the blessing, and now we're going to see Abraham gets the blessing from Shem. And then Abraham, we see that the blessing is very important in Genesis, that this blessing is very significant to the future. So I believe that interaction between Abraham and Melchizedek was Shem naming Abram as his heir. And that was Abraham receiving the priesthood of the world, and really that was fulfilled through his family. So reviewing the chronology, we've got 1996 B.C., Abraham's born. 1921, he enters Canaan, goes down to Egypt, possibly meets Job. 1912, he defeats Chedorlaomer and possibly meets Shem. So we have Abraham, Shem, and Job all within that 10-year period probably coming in contact with each other. And somehow Moses had all these documents going all the way back to Adam and Eve. So he had to have gotten them at some point. Abraham had to have had contact with his forebears in order to get that information. So 1897, Sodom is destroyed, and the following year, Isaac's born. When Isaac was 5, he is weaned. And the most, some scholars, they don't believe the Egyptian oppression began until Jacob went down into Egypt. But Floyd Nolan Jones believes that the oppression began when Isaac was weaned. And who was making fun of him when he was weaned? Do you know, Sammy? Remember when Isaac was being weaned and somebody was making fun of him? Anybody else know?
Ishmael.
And Ishmael's mother was from?
Egypt.
So even though it was just symbolic, the Egyptian oppression chronologically began, and that began the 400 years that God told to Abraham, or 430 years, that they would be oppressed by the Egyptians. So 1859, now remember, Abraham is, according to my theory, has just been recognized as the heir to the priesthood of the world about 50 years earlier. Isaac is now grown up, and I believe that God tests Abraham, this is a major part of his priesthood, is that the test of whether he will sacrifice Isaac. And of course, the test of Isaac, Abraham being willing to sacrifice him, and then at the last moment, the ram being substituted, what is that a picture of? That's one of the strongest pictures of Christ in the Old Testament. So I believe that was Abraham's first major event as the priest. So about 15 years after that, Shem dies. We do not know where his tomb is. I would love to find the tomb of Shem. And then another less than 20 years later, Abraham finally dies at the age of 175. And today's lecture was a bit shorter than usual, but I'm happy to entertain questions. So.
Did they find a pyramid in down south by the Peru that was about as great or greater than the pyramids in Egypt here recently?
There's one in Texas that has larger volume, but it's mainly dirt. It's not a hard pyramid. It's a man-made mound. Well, there is something very interesting now that you mentioned that. So if you look at the Great Pyramid, not the big blocks in the middle, but the old where the remains of the actual white granite casing is, they use the same kind of building method called megalithic architecture that you see in some other strange locations on the earth. The megalithic architectures, they had these huge stones. They're cut super precisely at weird angles, and they fit together very, very tightly with no mortar.
Yeah, like in the Easter Island.
Yeah, exactly. So this architecture appears to have been designed to resist earthquakes. I think after the flood, the earthquakes were very frequent for the first 1,000 years after the flood because the earth just went through all this trauma, and it's basically gradually getting back into equilibrium, and I think the earthquakes were much more frequent. So that's clearly an earthquake design that prevents the building from falling apart. But what's fascinating is it's a very unique design. Nobody goes out of their way to cut stones into multiple faces and stick them together like that because it's really hard to do. And we find about 12 sites around the world that use this method, and they're all in a straight line.
And we can't even do it.
They go from the Great Pyramid to Peru, a site called Ollantaytambo, a site called Cusco, and then to Easter Island. And all those sites are in a straight line, like an equator around the Earth at an angle, as if the North Pole was roughly in Hudson Bay, which is rough. Now, and that could be where the magnetic North Pole used to be. I don't know. But I suspect that all those structures were built around the same time period, and one proof of that is on the east coast of Australia, there is a site where there is a little cove in a rock on the coast, and in the cove there are hundreds of Egyptian hieroglyphs, and they're written in the Old Kingdom style, and they've been translated. And it basically says that one of the sons of Snefru, who was a king in the 4th dynasty, same dynasty as Khufu, he was sent here to explore, and the snake struck once, the snake struck twice, and he was not able to get away, and he died from the snake bite. So they didn't have the means to do their usual burial stuff, so they said, we did our best to honor his organs and honor the gods, and we've buried him here. So that says the Egyptians had discovered Australia in the fourth dynasty.
But you think the Nubians and the giants had to play it at that time frame?
The Nubians and the giants? So the Nubians would be one of the Kushite tribes, and we described Abraham. Abraham fights the five kings. What did the five kings do before they fought Abraham? They were attacking the giants who live around the rim of the Red Sea. I mean, the Dead Sea. So you have these giants popping up in various places in history. They'll be mentioned in Ireland after the time of the Exodus and Joshua's conquest. You have these giants invading Ireland called Formorians. And you have them mentioned in South America by the Incas and the Aztecs, and the Mayas also wrote about them. So were they a particular tribe of people that spread around the world? I don't think we know for sure.
So you don't know if they had play into the all these major structures that were built?
I don't think so. The reason I don't think so is even if I were 20 feet tall, I could not pick up a 1,000-ton stone, which a lot of these stones are that big. So even though you're bigger, it doesn't mean that you can do this just from muscle power. The people who built that were using advanced mathematics, technology, levers, machinery, and it was done with power of the mind, not power of the arm.
Do you have an idea of why know this might probably be a very hard question. Why God chose Abraham of all people?
Wow. You know, it's interesting because you would think that Shem, let's just talk about it in terms of the firstborn. Shem's firstborn was either Asher or Elam, or they were twins, possibly. I think Asher was probably the firstborn. And Asher later became the Assyrians, and they turned out to be some really bad people for quite a long time, right? And you have this story throughout the scripture of the firstborn fails, and the secondborn son rises to the job. And Shem has lived, you know, he lived 502 years after the flood. He was old, and all of his sons had failed. They had all fallen into idolatry. And so you would think, you know, after 450 years or so, he finally meets Abraham. So I think, you know, I can't say God chose Abraham because, you know, he chose him for the same reason he chose any of us, which is he ordained it before the world began. But from Shem's perspective, I think Abraham was in a lot of ways a hope. You know, he had hope, but he didn't know where God was ever going to provide a righteous heir. And then Abraham comes on the scene. And that's all I can speculate about it, really. So there are some things about Abraham. The Jews, they made up a bunch of stories about Abraham. So when you read Jewish sources on him, you can find some facts mixed in with some fiction. And you can kind of tease out why they did it. So the Jews, in their stories about him, they say Abraham, he refused to bow down to idols, so Nimrod burned him in a furnace, but he didn't burn up. And then he has a couple of other things that are things that later descendants of the Jews did. And I think that their logic was Abraham was the greatest of all the Jews because he was our forefather. Therefore, he must have done anything that was done later by the prophets. Abraham must have done equivalent things. So you have in Book of Jubilees and a couple of other Jewish sources this little struggle between Abraham and Nimrod. But Nimrod was dead before Abraham was born. It's impossible that Abraham and Nimrod ever met. So I think it's Jewish wishful thinking. And they're trying to make Abraham greater, but Abraham was great enough by himself. He doesn't need us to make up more stories about him. So.
Have you come across any kind of history on the floods for like the Sphinx and the pyramids of showing flood action?
Sure. I'll give you a little perspective on that. So the Sphinx is the oldest Egyptian monument, apparently. It's made of limestone, and it shows extreme surface erosion, like from acidic water running over it for probably centuries. And I believe the explanation for that is after the flood, you had a very high rate of rainfall for about 1,000 years that coincided with the Ice Age. Now, there's two possible sources of where all that rainfall was coming from. One is that after the flood, you had all this rock moving around and melting, and then you've got ocean water absorbing that heat and evaporating. So if the floodwaters at the end were warm, then you'd have a high rate of evaporation and high rate of precipitation. So the Sahara Desert used to be green. There were lakes and rivers in the Sahara, and they find out in the middle of the desert now where nothing can live. There's pictograms of sheep and goats and alligators, hippos. The other possible source is, I think I showed you guys when I did the lecture on the flood of how when those geysers broke open that shot the water out, it was under so much pressure, the fountains of the deep probably actually shot some of that water into space, which became comets and rock and water, comets and asteroids. And that if that were the case, you've now got a big cloud of basically water floating around in space along with the Earth, and the Earth's gravity is going to slowly sweep that up over the following millennia. And even today, they say that like something like 3 tons of ice is hitting the atmosphere every minute. There's constantly, the Earth is getting bombarded with snowballs from space. And so that, if that was at a higher rate in the past, that would account for... I said snowballs from space.
I just want to, that's what I thought.
Yep.
Is that a movie? They found a lot of new pyramids out there in Egypt. Quite a few.
Yep. Well, once they built the first one, everybody had to imitate. Yeah. But no one.
I was wondering about the floods, you know, that destroyed a lot of.
Yeah. So, evidence of erosion from rainfall is different from evidence of a flood. So, the Delta floods, but the Great Pyramid is built up on a rocky outcrop on high ground. So, I doubt that the Great Pyramid has ever been flooded. But further up the Nile Valley. When I say up, I mean up river. It's actually south. Thebes is where Egypt was actually began. That was in the south. It's like a canyon where the Nile goes through, and you've got maybe a mile wide of river bottom. And they had massive floods sometimes, which would bury everything. And then they'd flee up to the sides and then come down and start over and rebuild. So there are many, many layers of Egyptian artifacts and temples that are just buried under farmland. Yes.
Has anyone ever taken your picture at the Nile River?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, sure okay. enough. Cool. I might have that somewhere.
You might have that somewhere?
Yeah.
I got one, too.
That's my Indiana Ken picture.
Ken and I were at the Nile together, took each other's picture.
Yes. So the Europeans long, long wanted to find the source of the Nile. Even the Greeks speculated about the source of the Nile. And Dr. Clark and I did not find the source of the Nile, but we went all up to the falls of the White Nile. So we got a lot closer than most Europeans ever got.
And the barefooted teenage soldier with the AK-47 warned us to stay away from the water because of the crocodiles.
Yes.
Mm. I was more afraid of him.
Yeah. I've seen crocodiles. I was more worried about the crocodiles. Yeah.
I did get the water in my hand for the picture very quickly and then move away.
So since we have a little more time, I'll throw in a few more pieces that I left out of the main presentation. So around this time in history, you've got colonists going out and founding what became the nations of the world. The Irish, they've kept a very good record going all the way back to their original founding, which they say happened about 350 years after the flood, which would be roughly around the time Abraham was born. They say Partholin led the first colony to Ireland, so whoever Partholin was. Also, at this time in history, this is an interesting fact. The Assyrians sent a colony to Europe, and they built a city called Trebada, and that was named after one of their rulers. And today, it's the city of Trier in Germany on the Rhine River. It's the oldest city in Europe, and the Assyrians have had an ongoing connection with Germany ever since. We tend to think of Germans as, you know, a different tribal group in the Middle East, but the Assyrians had a sub-tribe called the Kermani, and you can kind of track them through history. In 500 BC, they're in Assyria, and then later you see them, they kind of migrated up into Asia Minor, and then they went up into the Carpathians, and their name gradually changed from Kermani to Germani. And by the time the Roman Empire, Caesar Augustus sent a legion, I think two legions, to fight against them. And they were defeated, and the legions were destroyed. And Augustus threw a temper tantrum. He said, "Give me back my legions." So that became kind of a famous phrase. So he later had a nephew or a grandson who went up and defeated the Germans. And they named him Germanicus because he was the conqueror of the Germans.
We know Germanicus from movies, right? Wasn't he in? Wasn't he Russell Crowe?
That could be. Yeah. Actually, it's all based on Russell Crowe. That's really the truth.
That's history. It's history. Real history.
I am so busted. Yeah. No.
Netflix and HBO.
So there's another foundation story in South America, in Peru. There was a Jesuit scholar named Montesinos, his father had been a conquistador who married an Inca princess, and so his mother was Inca and his father is a Spaniard. So he wrote a book where he basically got verbally, the Incas had a verbal story of all their ancestors going all the way back to the Tower of Babel. And they say that their first ancestor who led the people to this land was Manco Pirua, which sounds like probably he's Ophir in the Table of Nations. He's a Joktanite. One of the sons of Joktan was Ophir. And in Hebrew, the vowel is just, I can't remember, is it an A in? There's one letter for the vowel, and then there's PR. In Peru, they've just moved the vowel to the end, and it's the same PRU root. And we're told in Solomon's time, they would send ships to Ophir, and it would take 3 years to go there and get back. And scholars today are like, oh yeah, they were going down to Somalia. And you're thinking, okay, it took 3 years to go to Somalia and back from Ezion Geber is, or Eilat is the Israeli port on the Red Sea. Like, you could walk to Somalia and back faster than 3 years. Yeah. So, but they would come back with ships laden with gold. And to this day, Peru is the biggest gold mining center in the world. That's why when the conquistadors finally, when they conquered Peru, gold became cheap in Spain because they were bringing back boatloads and boatloads. They melted down all the artwork and all the idols of Peru, turned them into Spanish doubloons, put them on ships, sailed them back to Spain, and the English were like, hey, we'll give you a letter of mark for piracy if you want to catch some Spanish treasure galleons. And so the English were like preying on these little galleons, and every now and then they'd get sunk, so still people find, you know, treasures of gold in the Caribbean on the ocean floor. So I think that Ophir was Peru, and some people do, and some people don't. So,
but there's a written history that suggests
that. There's one other thing about that written history is about another 10 generations down from Manco Ophiro. They say that they had, in this king's time, there was a night time that lasted for 2 days or 3 days. And some have said this was around the same time as Joshua's long day. And what's really fascinating is the religions of Central and South America were obsessed with keeping the sun alive. Even, you know, when the Aztecs would sacrifice 100,000 people a year and eat them all, they were sacrificing them because they believed that the sun needed the lifeblood of these people or the sun would die. So I'm wondering if this event from their past where they remember the sun went out for 2 days or the sun didn't come up for 2 days, that they have a whole religion based on keeping the sun where it's supposed to be.
Incas came up in the United States around that escaped depressions down here?
Well, there's somewhere up here in upper South Carolina and in southern Georgia, there have been a couple of Mayan cities found. I don't know about Inca.
The Mayans had that blue clay they used to get up here in Georgia and Tennessee and take down there.
Also, the Iroquois say that they came from down there. The Iroquois escaped from the cultures of Central America and came up here to get away from them, to get away from people that were trying to eat them.
So,
yeah.
A couple of questions, not related. First one is, you had mentioned that Shem's sons, they were unfaithful to God. So the first question is, seems like more times than not, many of these significant figures in biblical history, they kind of went through the same thing, where their sons were not faithful to God. And so the first question is, why is that? What mistakes can we learn from them to improve, to help, you know, our succeeding generations to be successful as far as we, you know, what we can do? That's the first question. And the second question is there a standard by which we can affirm stories of antiquity that they're accurate? You know, do scientists have some kind of standard by which they say, yeah, that is accurate? You know, that this is accurate information, even though, you know, probably a lot of it is oral tradition. So that's my second.
Well, with oral tradition, you take the testimony of two or three witnesses, just like it's a court case, right? Anything that we hear, if only one person says it, how do we know if it's true? But if we have two or three witnesses who agree, then we have a case that it's probably true. That was the case, like I said, with what Ham apparently did to Noah. We have four ancient traditions from different cultures who agree he did something very specific to Noah that would prevent Noah from having future children. So I would say that's a strong historical case. Where you have, in the case of this king Khufu, Cheops, well, Herodotus told us a story about him that he learned from the priests of Egypt. And that was the only source we had for a very long time until Manetho mentioned him later in his histories. And then they started digging stuff up and they find Khufu's temple. And when they went in the Great Pyramid back, I guess, in the 1920s, they went up into there's some chambers up in the top that are stress relievers. So no one was ever supposed to go up there. And they went up there and they found a cartouche of Khufu up there saying by the work team of Khufu. So it's kind of like his signature is on the inside of the Great Pyramid. So when you put those pieces together, we can say, okay, Khufu was a real person. And we have evidence, both historical, Herodotus said he built the pyramid, and there's his signature inside the pyramid that we later found. So we put these things together to say that we have a basic historical picture of a real person and real actions that he did. The details could be fuzzy, but we know that he was real.
So does oral tradition, is that lesser than written tradition?
I think written tradition is the highest. But sometimes oral becomes written, such as the Irish Book of Annals. The Irish have these amazing records that go all the way back to Parthenon, and they seem to be very accurate. Some of their numbers are confirmed with stuff we found in ancient Babylon, but they were clearly oral records for a long time. So they managed to preserve accurate information.
Yeah. I'm recalling the little work by Josh McDowell called More Than a Carpenter, where he taught me about the way that historians judge the reliability of texts.
Mm-hmm.
And the three things I remember are one, internal consistency, whether it contradicts itself, and then two, whether there are other works, like you were saying, that say the same thing. And then thirdly, the number of copies that are available in antiquity. And the idea that match with one another. And so the idea being there was an original and it was copied, and we have a lot of copies, and so we have confidence that there really was an original that was that people believed was true because they're copying it. So those were the three things that I remember. And you know, as a side note, the New Testament is the most reliable historical document from the last 3,000 years. Nothing comes even close by the standards of atheist historians. They have to say the New Testament is the most reliable historical document on the planet. Nothing comes even close.
In terms of number of copies of the manuscript, internal consistency.
Internal consistency, extra-biblical sources that say the same thing, and then number of copies that are available.
Mm-hmm. Well, next month, will be heavily focused on Joseph down to the Exodus. And so I'm going to go into more detail on Egyptian history. What we have from Manetho is a list of, he basically lists out all the Egyptian pharaohs, but the list is so long it would go back 5,000 years because he gives a number of years. Many scholars have realized that several of these dynasties were ruling in different cities at the same time. So when Egypt was founded, there were seven little kingdoms. And then four of them merged into two, so then that put you down to five kingdoms. You had one period where you had the upper Egypt and lower Egypt against each other, so it had kind of grouped into two kingdoms. And then for a while you had what they call the Dodecarchy, where there were 12. But if you go at Manetho's dynasties, up to six of them were running at the same time. So they're in parallel. They're not sequence. And that's the chronology that I'm using is based on a paper that solves that problem, which I'll email to the list if anybody really wants to dig in. It's got like 1,000 footnotes. Yes, Matt.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh.
You done?
What?
Oh, sorry.
I was going to go back to Tuan's question about what we can learn from Shem and Abraham and
okay.
Our children turning away from the Lord. And I remember what God said to Abraham in Genesis 18. And I wonder, it's a wonderful theory that you present with Shem being Melchizedek and the line traced back to Adam and the seed of the woman coming through and this blessing that you discussed being so important. And that seed genealogy doesn't necessarily have to be literal biological. It can be associated with the blessing, perhaps, that you're talking about.
It was, in that, you know, Abraham was definitely the 10th generation descendant of Shem. There's no question about that. But it's interesting that when Jacob went down to Egypt, instead of saying, Joseph, I'm adopting you as my heir, he said, give me your two sons. And he laid his hands on them, like that, I think. And he adopted Joseph's two sons as his heirs, because the double portion, the adopted heir gets the double portion. So he basically was giving Joseph a double portion by adopting his two sons and making them equal with their uncles.
So even though it wasn't the very next generation, he was one of his heirs, and so a legitimate candidate for that blessing.
Right, but so I'm saying you have an example from the same time period of someone giving the blessing, choosing an heir who's not his immediate sons, but he's actually more than one generation down from him.
And we see what God did to Abraham in terms of giving him faith. And Genesis 18 says, the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I am doing? I think this is probably a really central answer to your question. Since Abraham, the question being, why do our children fall away from the Lord? Since Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. Listen what God says about Abraham. For I have known him in order that he may command his children and his household after him, that they keep the way of the Lord to do righteousness and justice, that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has spoken to him. So you might think, well, you know, a lot of people have done that, and their children still fall away. And my answer to that is really? Really? Have a lot of people really done this, and their children fell away? Have a lot of people really commanded their children and their household after them to keep the way of the Lord, to do righteousness and justice? Have they really done that? Have you really seen their children fall away?
There's one very notable exception in the Bible. I can't remember if it was Jeremiah. God tells them to call in the Rechabites. Call in the Rechabites and tell them to drink wine. And they wouldn't touch it. And they said, our forefather commanded us not to. And apparently he was multiple generations back in the past. So you had this one man who had taught his children, but it wasn't because of him that God, it's because the children obeyed their father for multiple generations, that God said, there will never be a time in history where one of the Rechabites does not belong to me. So this guy's line is never going to die out, and there will always be someone in his line who is part of the covenant. So I wonder where is the Rechabite today?
If he's standing up there, brother, it could be you.
Yeah.
And so the fifth commandment is a big, big part of this. Parents taking what's been given to them from their parents and passing it on to their children, and children receiving it in a solemn understanding of what they're receiving from their parents, with sober-minded reception. The holy opportunity that
we have. So you have that. You also have Jacob and Esau, where before they were born, God says, Jacob I've loved and Esau I've hated. So I think that you could definitely say if you fail to teach your children the covenant, they are going to turn away. But sometimes there are those ordained to perdition, and you taught them the covenant, and they fall away anyway. And like you said, it's hard. Who of us has perfectly followed the law of God? So what father can say that I perfectly taught my children the law of God? And I think ultimately we're dependent on the grace of God.
Well, and Abraham had children fall away by the droves, right? Even though he taught his children after him.
Yeah.
So it's the work that we do leads to generations
And sometimes a generation falls away, and the next generation, the kids come back. God calls them back. And sometimes they end up leaving their apostate parent to the Lord before he dies. I've seen that happen. So I think God just likes to show us his grace and his sovereignty, and that the rules are not mechanical like a machine. That the covenant is a story, and it involves people. And we do make individual decisions, and that's also interacting with the sovereignty of God.
For the here and the right now, the promises are to us and to our children, and the children have a responsibility to believe the promises. And so to the children, don't confuse yourself with whether you're chosen or elect or not, whether or not you have been foreordained to perdition or not. That is not how God wants you to think, or me, or Ken, or any of us. Today, obey God. Today,
I realized I forgot just to mention something in here. The Great Pyramid is at the very center of the world's landmass, like it's the belly button of the world. So I had mentioned there's evidence that the sons of Noah were trying to survey the world, and they could divide it up for inheritance. I believe that the Great Pyramid was the result of the survey project that. It later became the prime meridian of Egyptian longitude for you know, sailing around the world and stuff like that.
So it's a benchmark.
Yeah, just like Greenwich today, there's something in Greenwich that's the prime meridian of our longitude system. Well, the Great Pyramid was the prime meridian of the Egyptian longitude system.
You've got to have a start spot if you're going to divide the world up in fourths.
Yeah. Indeed.
Maybe that's like the corner of the world.
It's very possible.
Can't move that corner.
What's on the other side?
So maybe Aristosthenes wasn't quite as ahead of his time as he thought he was.
You're right, he was rediscovering things that were older. Yeah.
So you're telling us the world's not flat?
Pretty sure it's not.
It's not even round.
It's spherical. Yeah, it's toroidal. Toroidal. It's like someone sat on a beach ball. All right, thanks.
Thank you, brother.